Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you?
And we are in the midst of our ongoing investigation of trying to figure out how much the ancients really knew. And on that topic today, we have a guest that is really has some outstanding information on ancient knowledge of the electromagnetic spectrum. And we'll introduce our guest here, Glenn Kreisberg. Glenn, you there?
Yes, I am, Walter. Good morning.
Good. Good morning to you, and it's a pleasure to have you on, and we're really excited. Let me just input here that Glenn's a radio frequency spectrum engineer with Sprint, and he studies basically the wireless airwaves, and you can give us a little more background on this, Glenn.
Sure. Well, I'm a spectrum engineer, radio frequency engineer. I actually don't work for Sprint. I'm an independent consultant, but I do consult for all the large wireless telecoms. And I do a lot of frequency planning and as you said, spectrum engineering, which involves making sure that the signal strength is strong and the interference is low and everybody's calls stay connected. And sometimes it's a challenge, as everyone knows.
Excellent. And what really grabbed me was this article that you had recently written. It's posted on the Graham Hancock website for those that want to read it. It's called, Did Ancient Humans Have Knowledge of the Electromagnetic Spectrum? And let me just read a couple of paragraphs here. It's been suggested at various times that ancient humans had knowledge and use of unseen powers, forces, and energy fields. Could these unseen forces and fields consist of electromagnetic frequency waves and particle fields that make up the EM spectrum? This is not a simple question to answer. What evidence exists and what kind of evidence may come to light to support such a claim? There's no question that it has always existed. The EM spectrum is a naturally occurring part of our environment, comprised of a continuous sequence of electromagnetic energy arranged according to wavelength or frequency as generated by particle motion, vibrations, and pulses created from many sources. There's also no doubt that many ancient cultures had a connection with nature and natural forces that was fundamental and could only be described as intimate and profound in ways we moderns can merely attempt to comprehend. And I think we'd introduce the work of John Burke before on this program, where he showed that some cultures had a knowledge of electromagnetic spectrums. But I'm curious, Glenn, how you got interested in the whole idea that ancients might have had this knowledge yourself.
Well, while I was reading Graham Hancock's book, Underworld, I noticed he had mentioned in the description of some of the sites, particularly some of the temples on the island of Malta, how the land fell away in all directions from these locations. And it just occurred to me that that's one of the things that folks look for when looking for signal propagation is land that falls away in a gentle slope tends to allow signals to really propagate a great distance. Now, as I started thinking about this, it also occurred to me that there may be examples of waveforms depicted in architecture or in inscriptions or in motifs from ancient cultures, and I started looking for these symbols, and I found them. I found them in the Mayan pyramids of Chichen Itza. I found them in the weavings of Navajo Indians in their textiles, and these are patterns that resemble sine waves or box tooth waves or sawtooth waves. Common waveforms that are part of the generated EM spectrum.
And to our listeners, if you pull up that article on Graham Hancock's website, it has a number of images that Glenn has included in there. Glenn, your background really lends credibility to this whole topic because you know what to look for. And I'd like to get into a little bit more of that after the break, but First, let's just provide his website. Jeff, you have that?
Yeah, Glenn, your website is ashnews.org. It stands for Ancient Science and History News.
Actually, Alternative Science.
Alternative Science and History News.
Yes, that's ashnews.org, and folks can go there. There is a version of the article on there as well.
Oh, great. Super, super. Okay, well, you're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back with Glenn Kreisberg.
Welcome back to the program. Glenn, before we get started in talking about what the ancients might have known about the EM spectrum, which I think is really fascinating, could you give us an idea of what exactly we're talking about when we say the EM spectrum?
In layman terms, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, the electromagnetic radiation basically has been around since the birth of the universe, and for most folks, light is the most familiar form. Of course, electric and magnetic fields are part of the spectrum of electromagnetic radiation, and it extends from what we call static electric to magnetic fields through radio frequency, infrared radiation, all the way up to X-ray radiation. And a thorough examination of this subject really would include tracking some of the breakthroughs and discoveries that occurred throughout history that have led to the concepts and the principles. And in my article, I do have an appendix that kind of breaks down all of those. And I think one of the interesting things to note is that it appears that most of the concepts and ideas that were explored and developed regarding electromagnetism were done without the aid of modern high-tech detection tools, and those methods just didn't exist in the days of Maxwell and Faraday and the folks who were responsible for many of the breakthroughs and discoveries.
But it really runs from infrared to ultraviolet and includes gamma rays, radio waves, everything, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's all as you noted earlier, it's part of nature, and it's what I consider to be the single common denominator of everything.
Well, who was it? Was it Maxwell or Faraday or Newton that said it's sort of the foundation of physical reality that it underlies all of physical reality?
Well, that was a multiple choice question. I'm not sure which of those three, if it was those three. But I think, it's been said, and you know, I'm sure one of those geniuses did mention that.
Okay. And so our ancient ancestors, you know, whatever we think of them, we do know that they were very much in tune with nature. And so it's your observation that they would have been aware of this naturally occurring energy in some way or some form. Is that correct?
I do. I believe there are clues that they left that indicate that they may have had this knowledge. And, you know, it lies in the interpretation of certain symbols and images and inscriptions and motifs and things that we see on the architecture and on the tablets and remnants, archaeological remnants that have been dug up. We do see things that indicate something that is unknown to us but had deep meaning to them, and in some ways it correlates to some of the things we see today as far as wave forms, sawtooth waves, sine waves. These types of motifs are pretty common and universal throughout the ancient world. We do see,
especially as it related to the dragon form, you see this on a lot of ancient structures. And
a lot of times the dragon as a mythological creature was a symbol of an unseen force or something that affected human and civilization, but was unaccounted for. You couldn't really see this thing. It was more of a mythology or something that, it was a power of the gods, perhaps.
Right. Now, what are some of the specific sites where you find some evidence that there might have been a knowledge of subtle energies?
In the article, there are some photographs that point to some of these. One of the interesting ones, I think, is the profile of the Chichen Itzan pyramid in Mexico that certainly has what appears to be a sawtooth waveform built into its profile, if viewed from the side. And this is also the construction that creates a serpent shadow on the, I believe, on the equinox. And that same razorback edge is what I interpret as the form of a sawtooth wave. I also see it in many Native American motifs that have come from different sources. Many of them are books that I've read, pictures that I've seen in articles and in journals. Now, these are not the interpretations that are given necessarily by the authors or by the researchers. This is what I see when I look at it. I see box tooth, sawtooth, sine wave forms, pretty much universal in many of these inscriptions, artifacts, and items that have come down to us from the ancients.
Right. Well, this is a whole new field. I think you had mentioned you called it radio archaeology in your article there, and I think that's a great term. And but it's because of your background, your awareness of these patterns, and I guess is one of the things you do during your day job is determine where the best cell sites are and the best patterns.
That's one of the things I do. I also, in doing the spectrum planning, I make sure that the signal strength is the strongest and the interference is the weakest, so that the reception is great and the frame error rates are low, so people's calls don't drop. But also, for many years, I did design where I picked out site selection and evaluated site candidates and determined what would be a good location. Now, and I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that clued me into this field or the possibility of researching along these lines, when I was reading Graham Hancock's book Underworld, he was discussing the temples in Malta,
mm-hmm.
and I got struck by several of the passages in his work that seem to refer to the topography of the land around the temples and how they dropped away in all directions and sloped downward. And I couldn't help think that, that's exactly kind of what we look for in a site, so it will propagate a great distance to the next site. Now, of course, in wireless network design, we're talking a few miles. Now, when I saw the configuration of the temple on Malta called Hagar Quim, it was almost a eureka moment in some ways, because from a bird's eye view of this temple, it almost perfectly matches a modern 800 megahertz antenna pattern with its main beam and its side beams and its lobes and nulls between the beams. And it just, I found it quite remarkable. Now, of course, it could just be coincidence, but it started me questioning and wondering, what was the influence that had the folks on Malta 5,000 or 7,000 years ago. And this temple is, I believe it's the oldest freestanding structure on Earth, Hagar Quim, the temple on Malta.
And yeah, Malta goes well back into prehistory. And just for our listeners, this is not a square or rectangular building like we build nowadays. It is it's made of lobes, really rounded chambers, and it's the configuration of this roughly five lobes, six lobes, I can't recall, that, Glenn, you say reflects almost like a mirror image, the pattern you would get
from a dual pole antenna, a powered antenna, and which again struck me as very unusual. Why would something that old be shaped shaped in such a way? And there really is, it's really a mystery. I don't think anyone has really come up with any kind of explanation for why these temples have this configuration. Of course, it's not just the one temple. They all seem on Malta to be built with this lobe configuration, and I think Graham even referred to them as lobes, and of course in antenna patterns they're also referred to as lobes. So there is some type of correlation, at least visually, between the temples on Malta and what I see as modern antenna patterns in the work that I do. And what that means, we can only venture a guess, but I think if it's researched further, we might find out more, especially if we start looking into what the impetus was for the temple builders on Malta to configure their constructions in such a way.
Okay, so when you add up the combination of the the physical structures, how it resembles the pattern, the frequency pattern, as well as the physical or geographic location where it where it's in an ideal place to propagate a waveform. It's this data that helps you to draw this conclusion.
I would say that is, and again, I'm not necessarily drawing a conclusion. I'm making an observation that there is a an obvious correlation between the configuration of the temples built on Malta and a modern antenna pattern, and also between the type of location where they chose to build their structures, and the and the propagation properties that you would get from that location. And, of course, these are the things that we look at when we design a long-distance communication network, is where to place the site so that you'll get the maximum signal propagation, and what type of antenna pattern used so that you can direct that signal where you want it to go.
Right. And speaking of antenna patterns, I recall you also mentioned Callahan's work in the article.
Yes, Philip Callahan is an American scientist. He has a wonderful book called Ancient Mysteries, Modern Visions, which he discusses his research. Now, what Callahan was looking at, and these are, again, are very unusual and enigmatic structures, and they are the round towers of Ireland, which some people know about and other people have never heard of. But if you Google Irish round towers, you'll see wonderful images of these, which some of which still exist in their intact form. They, at one time, I guess there were hundreds of them, spread out over the Irish countryside, and most of them have been, it's been determined, were built in the 9th or 10th century by Celtic monks. And the reason that most given for the reason is protection from invading Vikings. Now, to me, this makes no sense. To Callahan, it made no sense. These towers are very tall, narrow structures. Their doors are very high. It wouldn't necessarily be a good place to hold up if there were a bunch of folks outside that wanted to get you out. They could easily smoke you out, I would imagine. So they had another purpose, and Callahan really goes a long way towards investigating what that was. There was another researcher, Lennox Barrow, who also has a book called Irish Round Towers, and he made the observation that these towers are all very uniform in their construction. None of them vary very much from one to the other as far as thickness. Of the walls, they seem to be very uniform. He speculates they were built by the same group of people who went from site to site constructing things, these things to very definite specifications. When I look at them and when I see how they're constructed, they remind me of a large wind instrument like a flute or a clarinet, where air would enter one end and reconfigure and then come out another end. Now, Callahan, he did believe that they were antennas for gathering electrostatic energy from the atmosphere. Of course, he was not able to actually prove this, but I think what was really fascinating about his studies is that they were based on, he correlated the towers to insect antennas and their capacity to resonate at certain electromagnetic frequencies. And he again, believes that they may have been designed and constructed and utilized as huge resonant systems for collecting and perhaps storing meter-long wavelengths of magnetic and electromagnetic energy coming from the Earth in the skies.
Well, hold that thought, Glenn. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Glenn, Callahan had also noted that the towers were made out of a stone that has a paramagnetic quality, and that the towers, although they were built by Christian monks in anywhere from the 6th, 7th century to the 10th or 11th century, they were actually built on much older sites. And so it appears that if there is some knowledge related to the selection of the sites, it might go back much farther. Any comment on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. They were built by using specific building materials. I think there are about 65 towers that still remain of the hundreds. They're pretty much ruined. A few of them are intact. 25 were built of limestone. 13 of iron-rich red sandstone, and the rest basalt. And all of these being materials that have paramagnetic properties and can be act as magnetic antenna and energy conductors. So I mean, again, it could be coincidence, but they went out of their way to get materials, and sometimes from a great distance, to build these out of a specific type of rock that did have these properties. There's also an interesting fact about the towers in that they are filled with rubble for portions of their interior, and Callahan believed this was not random, but was rather a method of tuning the towers more precisely to resonate at specific frequencies, not unlike tuning an organ or something like that by creating different length pipes.
Right.
So I found that also quite fascinating and hard to think that it was just a coincidence that they happened to fill each one to a different level that would create a different frequency as energy moved through the structure.
Yeah. I had commented on Callahan's work in my book, Lost Star, Myth and Time, and one aspect of it really knocked my socks off, and that was after he'd been studying these for some time, he was plotting them all on a piece of paper, and he kept saying to himself, this pattern looks very, very familiar. And then he realized that the distribution of the towers, if you put them on a blank sheet of paper, like dots on a piece of paper, it looked like the stars of the winter sky in the northern hemisphere.
So I've heard this as well. I have not seen diagrams, but mimicking some of the constellations and some of the brighter stars in the sky as pinpoints on the Earth.
Exactly. And the correlation is uncanny. I mean, some of the constellations are just perfectly set up. Other ones, there's a dot or two missing, a location or two missing. And when Callahan went and looked around for where it should be, he found a rune tower where they had taken the stones to use to build another type of building or a cemetery or something like this.
Sure, and that's why we probably will never know exactly how many there were altogether. And hundreds of them across the countryside does connotate some kind of, there was a design purpose in why they were spreading them out in the way they were. Either, I've also noticed that many appear to be almost equidistant. Many of them are very evenly spaced out from one another, which also, you know, it seems like there would be a purpose behind that. I find it really fascinating that they reflect the position of stars in the sky, and I think it would have been quite amazing for a survey project back in that time, in the early part of our millennium, or the first millennium, to have pulled that off.
I agree. Yeah, that's absolutely astounding.
Yeah. One of the other things you mentioned in the article has to do with the placement of the doors as well. And I think Callahan had mentioned that in his work too. And in some cases, the placement of the door correlated to where the tower had been filled with dirt or rubble, and in other places they don't. But there's some speculation that the placement of the door has something to do with how the towers were tuned, if that's what they were used for. And then, of course, on the other side of the speculation is that, well, the doors were just built up high so that treasure and monks and people could be kept safe in them if they were ever under siege. But I think you also point out in your article that towers are actually a really horrible place to hide people or things in when you're fighting against Vikings who are quite adept at smoking things out of small spaces.
Out bees, yeah. Yeah, from trees.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be trapped basically. When I first was looking at these things, I was thinking maybe they because they are so tall, they're over 100 feet. Maybe they played the shell game. They would spot the Viking horde coming and, you know, quickly run to the next tower and get up there, and then when they saw the enemy coming towards them, they'd head to another, you know, just kind of always staying one step ahead, which you know, I suppose they, if they were well organized, they could flee in that fashion and just always keep one step ahead of the enemy. But it just doesn't really make sense if you start picking it apart.
Right. Well, when you put all this evidence together, and one thing you didn't mention in your article, which really helps reinforce the case for me, is John Burke's work, Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, where he took the flux magnetometer to the 66 remaining stones at Avebury and found that they're all unidirectionally aligned by polarity. So the, you know, the positive pole at one points to the next one, and you know, there's just too much of this of these coincidences to think that the ancients didn't have some knowledge of subtle energy.
Well, now I know John Burke, and I'm glad you brought him up because he did some very interesting work in upstate New York on what we call the Putnam County Stone Chambers, and these stone chambers, and I believe I mentioned them just briefly in the article, because there was a researcher about 20 years ago who went around to these stone chambers and measured electromagnetic anomalies occurring at the majority of them. Now, these chambers are really a mystery in themselves. They a lot of them have been attributed to Celtic influences, and some of them have been speculated to be over 1,000 years old. If you were to talk to a traditional historian, the official verdict is that these things are colonial in nature and were built by the settlers in the early historic times as root cellars and things of that nature. But
exactly, because they're not allowed to admit that Europeans were over there before then. Hold that thought, though. We'll be right back. Continuing with the North American megalithic structures, if that's what you want to call them.
Yeah, and the Celtic connection. Many of these stone chambers found in the northeast of the United States have been attributed to Celtic influences, to perhaps Celts who visited the country either intentionally or accidentally, you know, thousands of years ago, or perhaps more than 1,000 years ago. Nobody's quite sure. But John Burke has had an interest in these, and he has sent some researchers who have also measured electromagnetic properties associated with these chambers. And, you know, they are also located on geologic formations, bedrock, and other things in the area that would create, or outcroppings, I should say, bedrock and outcroppings, that would create these electromagnetic properties that are measured at these sites. One of the things that indicates that they are Celtic in origin, and one of the most interesting things about these chambers is that nearly all of their front entrances are oriented to the winter solstice sunrise. So, you know, mm-hmm. The folks, not to take credit away from the early Dutch settlers, but I don't think that they were that in tuned with building their root cellars to be aligned with solstice sunrises and sunsets and the like. So that's a pretty good indicator that these were constructed by people who had interest in astronomy and the movement of the stars and the sun and when things occurred in the heavens, and that was of paramount importance. And it appears that these the round stone towers of Ireland fall into that category as well.
Right, so there's some connection there. And, I think John Burke had showed a slide at one of the CPACs about his instruments being fried when they were sitting in one of these chambers. And that's another story. But
yeah, another interesting aspect of the chambers is, and I've only found this out recently as I was researching the orb energy phenomenon that I've been looking into, and I asked folks who have taken pictures of these chambers to look through their pictures again and see if there are any anomalies or photographic images of things that look unusual. And sure enough, I got pictures from quite a few folks, and they showed energy patterns in their digital photographs taken at these sites. And I think that's an interesting phenomenon that's just starting to get some attention. I think it has a lot to do with the proliferation of digital cameras, especially 5 million pixel and greater, which seems to be the standard now that everybody has and is clicking away with unlimited, no limitation of film. So we're seeing a lot of things that we may not have seen previously showing up in digital images.
And didn't I think the article you also mentioned that the anomalies described at these New England chambers were like pulses that seemed to occur in a specific frequency range? Do you recall what that is?
Yes, I do believe they seem to be around the 16 and 16.5 megahertz with a peak signal occurring at 1675 megahertz. And this the folks who measured these felt that this could be suggestive of some type of doorway or portal function for these chambers with the burst of EM energy released whenever this portal activated or something along those lines. It sounds kind of out there, but at the same time, nobody knows what the functionality of these things was, and to make any kind of assumption as to what it wasn't, I think, is pretty much jumping the gun. You can't say what it is. You certainly, you have a tough time also saying what it isn't.
Sure.
Right. To jump back a little bit to Malta, I think one of the other interesting things you mentioned was its connection to some of the mythology surrounding the island, as far as legends of the sirens, and how the temples there might somehow relate to that legend.
That is another interesting aspect, and this would kind of go along the lines of a communication network. And these sirens, these women from that era who had the ability with their voice to create, really high intensity and high pitched frequencies. Perhaps they were utilized from these locations with these structures acting as an amplifier to send signals to ships out in the Mediterranean or to across to another island. It would be interesting to try to recreate some experiments where you could try to recreate this and see if it is possible. I don't know that we would, we'd have to maybe employ the greatest opera singers we have these days, because that, I think, is what would equate to the sirens of the days gone by. But that was absolutely an interesting aspect of the mythology and the culture that existed on Malta. And of course, the goddess cult was very, very prominent in Malta, and many figurines and statuesques have been found of the sacred goddess, which I think a lot of people believe might be the earliest form of worship by modern man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, this whole field of radio astronomy, I'd love to see you push this forward a little bit so that more archaeologists will look at these sites, not just in terms of, dating them or figuring out a little bit about the culture from some of the physical artifacts, but really looking at some of the non-physical, the acoustical and subtle energy artifacts, which may still be there.
Yes, absolutely. And there are quite a few researchers who are beginning to take a look at this and believe that there is something more there. I think they're being very tentative and kind of stepping in slowly. But I do believe as time goes on, people will be looking at these other properties that you mentioned as being significant in determining what the true use of some of these ancient sites are. It ties in a lot with a lot of modern research that's going on that also incorporates electromagnetic fields, and it's also in its infancy. Some of the work by I know, Walter, you're familiar with Valerie Hunt,
right,
the former UCLA.
UCLA, right.
Yep. And there's also the work of Dr. Michael Persinger, who also has done a lot of neurology and what he calls neurotheology, having to do with the spirituality of the brain. And, you know, and I do believe that electromagnetic fields and electromagnetic properties in the universe, on the planet, that we encounter ties in strongly with this.
Okay, well, let's get into that in the next segment. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. Glenn, by looking at this bigger picture of what the ancients might have known and subtle energies, I think it will help us better understand, you know, the true nature of these cultures. And I was struck by the recent finding just in the last few weeks about this structure in Casma, Peru. Did you read about that? I think it's in excess of 5,500 years old, so it's older than Corral, Peru, not too far away.
Right.
And they dug up this structure. And, you know, nowadays when you find a foundation of a building, it's usually a few squares and rectangles, and, you know, we know that that's where the walls were. In this structure, it has some triangle features and quite a number of curved features, something very complex that you wouldn't see in a foundation of a building nowadays. And archaeologists are just baffled on how to interpret that. What was this used for? And hopefully by understanding subtle energies, we can start to, you know, draw up some answers to those questions. But you were talking about this field of neurology. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Well, I think there are some interesting theories out there these days about how electromagnetism and electromagnetic fields affect the brain. And some of the leading researchers on this field have demonstrated that cut the brain off from all electromagnetic fields entirely, and you pretty much have a breakdown of the psyche of the person.
Right, that's Valerie Hunt's work.
Valerie Hunt's work in creating these Faraday chambers that cut off all electromagnetic fields went a long way to showing that the human condition is not normal without the presence of electromagnetism and these fields, and their effect on us is really only now beginning to be understood. And I think when you describe them as subtle, it's very appropriate, because what Hunt's work showed was that very minute changes in the electromagnetic field created changes in how we function. And I believe Persinger, his work goes a long way towards collaborating what Hunt has shown, and that is that we are absolutely affected by the electromagnetic fields that surround us on the planet, and that changes in these fields do occur, and that when they occur, they affect our mind. And I do believe that this is something that the ancients were aware of and utilized in a way that we are basically clueless to these days. And maybe we're just beginning to get some indication of how they use this energy and how maybe in the future we will use it in ways ourselves.
Right. It strikes me that this, you're really onto something here, that these ancient structures are not just simply communication devices, but almost like beneficiation devices. They somehow benefit mankind, either as states of consciousness or as crops around the towers, as Callahan seemed to show, or, you know.
Perhaps both.
Or perhaps both, yeah.
And this is one of the things they speculated the Celtic monks used these towers for in Ireland, was not only to bathe their fields and their crops with electromagnetic waves, but also their brains, so that they could enter into deeper states of meditation. And this has also, I think, been demonstrated through some experiments that when you're exposed to certain frequencies, basically ones that enhance the brain's natural wavelengths and brain waves, you are put into a state that's much more closer to, I mean, what we considered an altered state of consciousness or a meditative or trance-like state. And I think that's very important. and I know it ties in greatly with your research, Walter, at Binary Research, at the Binary Research Institute, and trying to determine what effects our cosmos have on our consciousness, either raising or lowering it over periods of time when the EM fields change around the Earth.
Very much so, right? That seems to be a theme of this very ancient myth and folklore about this rise and fall of civilization, and which, you know, modern scientists sort of write off as just gobbledygook, and yet over 30 cultures talked about this. And so, yeah, I definitely think there's something to that. And so I appreciate you reinforcing that.
Yeah, well, you know, there is evidence out there, if people choose to look at it, that that really does back up the theory that humankind went through some period of devolution in mathematics and science and technology before we began to rise again to the current level that we're at. The devices, this it's been in the news in the past year. I wrote about it a few years ago. Of course, you'll know what I'm speaking of, the anti-Catheria mechanism found off a Greek isle. And I use this as a to illustrate the point in my article about how we're missing a lot of the links that are going to tell us what really happened in our past. And some of the missing links are some of these artifacts. The Baghdad battery, this antithera mechanism, that are just enigmatic. And because they're enigmatic, they're not looked at by traditional science, but the fact is they exist and they represent something that's far, far more advanced than what traditional academic science attributes them to being.
See, well, if it doesn't fit the theory, pretend it doesn't exist.
Right. Well, and unfortunately, that's kind of the status quo of how academia operates. But I think it does a great disservice to discovering true knowledge by not considering these things when investigating.
Sure. Well, your work here is, I think, helping to show that if we take a wider view of things and use a greater understanding of the natural world, that we can put the pieces together in a way that makes a little bit more sense. Unfortunately, again, Glenn, we're coming to the end of this show, so we'd like to thank you for being on it, and once again, let everyone know your website. Can you give that to us?
Certainly. Ashnews.org, A-S-H, news. We're .org because we are selling nothing. We are just trying to disseminate some interesting ideas for people to read and consider and hopefully open and expand your mind to some new possibilities.
Well, we're buying. So thanks for being on the show, Glenn.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to Cosmic Influence. Reminder for everyone that CPAC, the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge, is coming up the end of the year, October 4th and 5th at UCSD. Got a couple of new features this year. One is we'll have quite a number of poster presentations, and Glenn will be giving one of the poster presentations. And we have a bonus panel that we can't quite talk about yet, but we're very excited about.
And also, once again, if you'd like more information on the work we do here at the Binary Research Institute or on Walter's book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, visit us online at www.binaryresearchinstitute.org for the Institute or for the CPAC conference, cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com. Until our next episode,
bring on the higher ages.